Новое дело возбуждено.
Новый скандал в оборонном ведомстве.
Сегодня получил продолжение коррупционный скандал с оборонсервисом.
Глава Минсельхоза Елена Скрынник, которая оказалась в центре коррупционного скандала.
Бывший министр сельского хозяйства Елена Скрынник. О финансовых махинациях рассказывает фильм
«Власть». Corruption scandal at the Defense Ministry. A corruption scandal at the Regional Development Ministry. A corruption scandal at the Agricultural Ministry. A corruption scandal involving the Global Navigation Satellite System. A corruption scandal over preparations for the APEC summit. A corruption scandal at the Chelyabinsk Regional Health Ministry. Did I miss anything? I'm sure I did. Oh yeah, the scandal involving the CEO of Ross Telecom. Is that everything? I'm sure I missed something. Never mind. There have been raids, there's been arrests, there's been resignations, and there's been firings. It's been dizzying and difficult even for criminology junkies like us to keep up with. The state-controlled media is calling it a campaign against corruption. But in Russia, nothing's ever that simple. So what's really going on? A purge of the ruling class? A clan war in the elite? An old-fashioned kompromat war? Or just chaos? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian Service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And on the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galeotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the must-read blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey there.
Mark, let's get things started with you. When the apartment of Rostelecom CEO Alexander Pravatorov was searched this week, it got my attention for one reason. He's undoubtedly a Putin man. He's currently a witness in a case in which investigators allege that a now bankrupt subsidiary of an investment fund he used to head fraudulently received a loan and then defaulted on that loan. The case comes as Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev has been trying to replace Pravatorov at Rostelecom and replace him with an old law school classmate. Putin may have intended this anti-corruption campaign to be a public relations trick, a purge of the ruling elite of disloyal elements, or both, but now it seems to be spinning out of his control. Do we have a clan war on our hands now?
I think we have a sort of clan war. What I would say is, first of all, it's interesting in that this emphasizes the point that we can't neatly decategorize people as Putin people or Medvedev people and think that that sort of somehow encapsulates the lot. Everyone has multiple identities. Everyone has multiple roles and functions and affiliations within the elite. So, of course, Pravatorov was indeed a Putin man. But nonetheless, there comes a point when, first of all, you may become too inconvenient, but secondly, you might step on the wrong toes. I think, first of all, we just have to be careful about these labels. But the second point I'd make about this question of a clan war is, yes, inevitably, as soon as you have any kind of anti-corruption campaign, and it's clear that the one is at long last beginning to roll out, in part for good reasons and in part for bad political ones, everyone will therefore use that as an opportunity to settle old scores, to build empires and so forth. These things always develop their own momentum. And I think the point is, in the past, Putin has actually been able to manage and enjoy that because he's been in a strong position. What I'm not sure about is now whether Putin of the current vintage is quite so able to actually control it and prevent it from going out of control.
So did he make a mistake politically by launching this thing?
I don't think so. I think it was that thing that we're not used to seeing from Putin, a calculated risk. Usually he prefers to bet on safe things. Corruption was, frankly, and is, frankly, the Achilles heel of the current administration. It's the one issue which can really unite a whole variety of different groups against it. And, frankly, it was also bleeding the state dry, or is. Definitely, Putin had to do something about it, unless he would just slide into shabby kleptocracy. An anti-corruption campaign was necessary, politically as well as economically. The point is, though, that it carries risks with it, and we don't really know how it's going to play out. It might actually help to re-legitimize Putin. Or, on the other hand, it might begin to throw up so many internal rivalries and so much sort of general bad behavior that it actually makes the whole system look corrupt.
Now, up until now, and I know, and you're correct to say this distinction between Putin and Medvedev people is fraught with peril, but up until now, a lot of this seemed to be taking revenge on people who, for one reason or another, during the time of the tandem, had
either sided with Medvedev or tried to play Medvedev's side against Putin for their own interests at the time. And Serdyukov obviously comes up, it comes to my mind regarding this. Kirill, what do you think? Did Putin make a mistake launching this war?
I think that if we can define this as like, you know, an anti-corruption campaign, it failed. It failed now from the point of view of public relations. Just recent results of opinion poll research by Levada Center. Ratings of Putin himself, of Medvedev, of the government, of Duma, they are falling. Mm-hmm. They are falling. Usually, if you are if you're launching a kind of anti-corruption campaign, you have to be like Stalin in 1930s or like Mao in the end of 1960s when he began his great purges and so on. So you have to keep distance from everything that is happening in the ruling elite, because you, who is a lone ruler, is purging the ruling class. And you have to be alone, you have to keep distance. But at the same time, you have to be inside the situation, into the situation, yeah? It's a very complicated position, and I think only political geniuses, like in some sense, of course, like Stalin and Mao, evil geniuses, but anyway, they can play this game. But for Putin, it was a great mistake even to just to begin this campaign, because the situation is a little bit out of control now in Russia. And, you know, strains or ties, they are softening, loosening now in Russia, and especially in this ruling elite. When you are beginning this anti-corruption campaign, you have to base yourself on something, you know, hard. Mm-hmm. Strong. But there is no any, you know, kind of some foundation for this campaign in modern Russia for Putin. It couldn't be, you know, the internal ministry. It couldn't be KGB, even KGB, because KGB is divided between, you know, several fractions and so on. It couldn't be the office of prosecutor, general prosecutor in Russia. So who can do all these purges? So in this case, all this campaign is, you know, becoming kind of a chaos, as you told, mm-hmm. a chaos as a war against, you know, of everyone against everyone. Yeah, that is the main failure of all this process.
And the problem is that Putin's too close to it.
Yes, he cannot keep distance, even being, you know, ill, or I don't know what's happening with him just now. But anyway, he cannot keep distance from all these processes and so on, because so many close friends of him are involved in this, you know, corruption, anti-corruption process and so on the both sides of the process.
Well, this is part of the problem, is that, I mean, it's almost by design, but in Russia, and specifically in the Russian elite, it is really, really hard to stay clean. So everybody has something. Everybody has a skeleton in their closet, and usually more than one. And this is a method of control that people like Putin have historically been able to use to keep people in line. You can be corrupt up to a point, but if you step out of line politically, I'll use that corruption to crush you. Mark, what about that? Is Putin too close to this to be able to carry it, to effectively use this strategy now?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that people have been able to use the anti-corruption weapon even while being corrupt and even while protecting other people. I mean, I think there are possibilities that Putin could use this as an opportunity to effectively recast his political narrative, that he is the czar who is the only person who can keep the boyars in check. And that's a classic model, and it could help precisely reverse those falling poll ratings. But that works only under two circumstances. First of all, if you genuinely can keep the boyars in check. And I think he still has his weapon, and it is clear that the investigations committee still remains the weapon. It's interesting that it's very much it's Vladimir Malkin, who's always the guy who's up sort of detailing today's corruption arrests and things, you know, on behalf of the investigations committee. So very much that is the current purge committee, shall we say. So I think he's able to do that. up to a point. But the main, for me, the main thing is Putin and the whole kind of Putin political apparatus nimble enough to be able to recast itself, to be able to build a compelling narrative that does two things. One is it manages to convince the Russian people, okay, vast amounts of corruption happened in the early Putin years, but somehow we've had a change of heart, we've only just noticed, and we're the ones who can fix this problem. But secondly, that can also actually convey to the boyars, to the members of the elite, look, we're having to do a bit of a house cleaning. The rules of the game are shifting slightly. The acceptable level of corruption may be shifting slightly, but don't worry. We're not planning on sweeping away the lot of you. There's going to be ample opportunities for the rest, because that's the key thing. It's all right to begin to focus on, you know, here are some bad apples. If everyone starts feeling vulnerable, there is the danger that they all come, you know, not in some kind of sense of a big room, of a cabal, but you know, as an elite, the consensus becomes this regime is dangerous. So that's a very, very delicate balancing act. And I'm not entirely sure that Putin, and especially the people Putin has got around him, his political technologists, are going to be nimble enough to manage that.
And to be nimble enough, I guess if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying sending the one message to the elite and sending another message entirely to the population. This is a real anti-corruption campaign for the population, but for the elite, don't worry about this. This is just for show. Is that what you're saying?
Well, not so much just for show, but just look, here are new rules of the game. Mm-hmm. As long as you manage to adapt to those, you're going to be fine. And for a certain number of you, there are going to be massive opportunities. Because again, if we think back to Stalin, and here I'd agree entirely with Kirill. I mean, you know, he was an evil genius, but you know, a genius in how he managed it. He managed on the one hand to keep the elite terrified of the center, but on the other hand, thinking, wow, you know, if I play the game well, there are massive opportunities to almost literally step into dead men's shoes and rise rapidly. So it was that balance of opportunity and terror that worked. Now, Putin can't, thank God, bring the same level of terror, but I'm not sure if he can also convey the same level of opportunity. Mm-hmm.
Kirill, you wanted to add something
here. Yes, as for me, I'm absolutely agree with Mark. And I'd like to go on with his metaphor of, you know, this political purges and the change of political, sorry for my French theory jargon, the change of discourse. Who was the, you know, a pioneer of political purges in Russian history? Ivan the Terrible. Ivan the Terrible, who divided the country into two parts. Zemshchina and Opritchnina, who established a kind of a new bureaucracy, and at the same time it was not just bureaucracy, it was a new kind of army, Opritchniki, and that was a great and very effective tool to make all these purges. So this is a political game, it's tragic political game, but that was a political game which was connected with two things. First of all, usually all these campaigns of purges, of anti-corruption and so on, it's a game of good boys against bad boys who looked like a good boys in the previous times.
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, you have to find some words to describe why do these boys who are so bad now was so good, 2 months ago. Because me or, you know, Ivan the Terrible or Stalin or Mao had a very close relationships with all these now, today, bad guys. So you have to explain how it happens.
If Comrade Stalin only knew what was going on, he would take care of this. Remember, this famous statement.
So that is the question of a new political discourse. You have to change it. If you are not changing your narrative, political narrative, as market defining is this, or political discourse, you are just launching a campaign which will be or should be out of control in several months, because you can't explain it to the population of the country. And we are not living now in the 16th century when it was absolutely enough to explain something to by several boyars and opritchniks and so on. Because now it's an age of TV, now it's an age of internet and so on, and you have to find the words. But Putin didn't find these words for this campaign.
Well, I guess my question, and I'll go to Mark with this first, is it even possible now, after being in power for 12 years, to change your narrative? Number one. And number two, is it possible to control the narrative in the age of the internet and social networks?
I think we shouldn't overstate the extent to which the age of the internet suddenly democratizes everything. I mean, I think it just simply means that it's a different way of controlling narratives and so forth. I think it is possible, but the question is whether in these circumstances it's probable. And yeah, I think the point that, in fact, that Putin has been in power for so long does actually create a real obstacle for him. I very much appreciated Kirill's raising of Ivan the Terrible's parallel, if nothing else, because I was in terror of using such parallels, knowing his usual fear of historical examples.
I feel
I now have free reign.
You've opened a Pandora's box.
Let's take two other examples of rulers who built part of their legitimating myth on that they were the clean people in a dirty system. Nicholas I and Yuri Andropov. In both cases, they identified kind of reservoirs of personnel that they could turn to. For Nicholas I, it was Baltic German aristocrats. Russians are all corrupt, so I'm going to have to bring in our own Germans. Similarly, Yuri Andropov, it was KGB and certain elements of the Interior Ministry. Whether or not they were any less corrupt is a very questionable matter. But nonetheless, at least kind of there was identified a reservoir of personnel. Putin 1.0, the Siloviki, were in way that. They were the new aristocracy. They were the best and the brightest. Well, we've now seen that degenerate into shabby, venal corruption. Where else does Putin go? I mean, I think this is one of the interesting things. It's all very well crafting this narrative, and it is possible to do. But to do that effectively, you have to be able to say, we have different people coming in. It's very hard to say, these three identical men in expensive grey suits, one of them is a really bad person, one of them is an unknown factor, and one of them is the saviour. The Shoigus of this world, who actually can be brought in as sort of new figures, they're very rare, and B, what's interesting about Shoigu is he predates Putin.
He's not that new.
He already has had a really strong career before Putin was around. So in some ways, he's not quite as associated with the Putinistas. My thought is precisely, if you're going to build this narrative, one of those ingredients has to be the new men, new people, who are going to be brought in. And I'm not sure where Putin can find those credibly.
I wanted to shift a little bit to talking about one of the things we think is going to happen out of this is that a clan war is brewing. Who are the clans? Now, one of the simple ways this has been presented in the Russian media is it's the White House against the Kremlin. It's the presidential administration versus the government. It's Putin against Medvedev. There's a little bit of truth to that, specifically with the teams. I'm not sure this is a Putin-Medvedev fight in the personal sense, but their teams are certainly at odds. Is it that simple? Can we break it down that simply? I want to get from both of you on this. Mark, let's start with you.
I think my answer is it that simple? God, no. There are, the point is, multiple identities. There's not one way of assessing, whose team you're in. And in many ways, look, given my own miserable, moral, bankrupt proclivities of research, I can't help but be looking at organized crime, wherein it's quite easy to be a member of one particular gang and a member of a wider network, and also have side interests and side affiliations, and also maybe to have ethnic ties with others. So actually, in crime, you can have multiple identities. We think of people as being a member of a gang. That's not the way it works. But likewise in politics, if we're looking at the gangs in politics, yes, there is a fault line, shall we say, between the Putinist and the Medvedevite, the White House and the Kremlin teams, though they're very porous and in many ways they share common interests in keeping the status quo going. There are Siloviki versus technocrats. There are shareholders versus managers. But above all, I think there are lots and lots of subgroups that are built around just groups of people who know each other, groups of people who have interests in common. And the thing is, these clans, which I think back in the 90s were much more coherent, I think are now these kind of loose constellations of smaller subgroups and individuals, all of whom regard themselves as political entrepreneurs in their own right, all of whom reserve the right to shift affiliation or to emphasize certain aspects of their affiliation as the needs of the day are. I mean, let's take Sechin as one of the classic examples. He's often brought up as the sort of the Eminenskriegs or the Siloviki. Well, actually, his interests nowadays are much less concerned with what's the size of the defense budget and much more with what's going on within the energy sector. And therefore, in some ways already, he's got two key affiliations, which sometimes are in alliance, but actually need not be. He's also got personal relationships that cut across and are separate from either of these big institutional ones. He's ex-GRU, but he's clearly not putting any political effort into protecting the GRU in a way that in the 1990s he did and he would. So I think, again, this is it. These are all negotiable affiliations, and that's what makes the situation so dangerous. If it was a nice straightforward thing of, I don't know, you know, identify five clans and they're fighting, then A, Putin could understand the algebra of power. Who to support today in order to keep the others in check and so forth. But also, one could definitely see, well, you know, these are the battle lines. The point is, at the moment, it's all so amorphous. Mm-hmm. The battle lines are wherever they are today, and they'll be somewhere else tomorrow. Today, it's Rostelecom. Who knows where it's going to be tomorrow?
And this actually puts one of Putin's key skills has been the ability to be the arbiter among the clans, the balancer, the holder of the balance among the clans. But if this is becoming and just this amorphous mishmash, how do you play the role of the indispensable Putin, the indispensable arbiter? In the answer, I think, is that you can't. Would you agree with that?
I think Putin is failing now his position as a arbiter or keeper of the balance and so on. And the beginning of this failure was the launch of this system of Putin Medvedev Duumvirat. Because Medvedev was kind of, pseudo-arbiter or pseudo-keeper of the balance during time from 2008 till 2012. And at the same time, there couldn't be two or three keepers of the balance. You could be the only one figure. Secondly, you have to... I'm returning to my initial idea, sorry. But you have to explain somehow, not just for those who are, participating in this game, but for people outside, what's going on, to instruct them in the internal politics. Not just revealing the truth, but explaining somehow what's going on, what's going, why did Serdyukov was an excellent defense minister several weeks ago, but now he's not. What happened in this time? Can you imagine, an inhabitant...
If Comrade Putin had only known.
Yes. Mao Zedong and Stalin could answer this question, but
because people really believed Comrade Stalin had only known.
And now they don't. At this point, we are returning to the results of Levada opinion poll research. Numbers are very poor, even in Putin's Russia context. They are very, very poor because usually when you're initiating an anti-corruption campaign, all the ratings of those who are behind this campaign, begin to grow, in week or in 2 weeks, but not now.
What's
going on? Or this people or the population in Russia is, beginning not to trust wholeheartedly in Putin's regime, but they begin to, some kind of irony or
they're laughing at it.
Yes,
we're going to get to that in the second half.
Yes, they are not quite serious about they were not quite absolutely serious about Duma, about government and so, but they were serious about Putin himself.
Yeah,
and the situation is changing now. And that is the result of this political summer and the beginning of political autumn. because this so-called new Khrushchev or Putin 3.0 and so on, he is not all these things. They are not very efficient in political and ideological terms. They are not official because they, once again, sorry, they couldn't and they cannot explain to the population what's going on in the country.
And that is a good note to shift, because in a few moments we are going to continue our discussion but shift the focus a bit and talk about how both Putin and Medvedev have seen their political capital diminish significantly in recent weeks. I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galeotti, author of numerous books on Russia and of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
If our people entrust me with such work in the future, I do not rule out such a turn of events, of course. But that depends on a whole combination of factors. Generally, one should never decline anything. Never say never, as you know, especially since I have already entered this river once. And this is a river that can be entered twice.
That was Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev making his much ridiculed announcement that he may seek the Russian presidency in the future. And here is Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov addressing, yet again, the issue of the health of President Vladimir Putin.
Putin continues working, and he intends to continue working at the same pace. And he is not going to give up sports. So, like any sportsman, he can have some pain in his back, his arm, or his leg. But that has never affected his ability to work. Rumors about Putin's health are highly exaggerated.
Rumors about Putin's health have also led to inevitable comparisons with ailing Soviet leaders who constantly disappeared from public view. So one is becoming a punchline and the other is apparently ailing and increasingly isolated. It's the incredible shrinking tandem. Kirill, let's start with you and let's start with Medvedev. It wasn't just the announcement about possibly re-seeking the presidency that got Medvedev mocked this week. Watching that video he put out promoting road safety, absurdly clad in a leather hoodie and driving a late model BMW SUV, you had to feel sorry for the man. On one hand, he looked so earnest. And the problem of road safety and drunk driving are very real ones in Russia. But the video itself was so easy to parody, and it was mercilessly. Is Medvedev finished politically?
He was finished from the very beginning politically. Sorry, but that is the truth. Because if you agree to play this ridiculous game as a second part of so-called tandem or duumvirat, which is not equal to the other part, because tandem, when you are speaking tandem, you imagine two, you know, equal forces or two equal figures who are participating in this duumvirat or in this tandem, yeah? But from the very beginning, tandem consisted of one man, that was Putin. And Medvedev's figure was, partly a pseudo-Putin number two, and on the other hand, he was a pseudo anti-Putin.
Yeah.
It was a very strange, a very strange mix of various aspirations of, part of Russian society. They condensed on the place, on this empty place, which was and still is Dmitry Medvedev. All the things which everyone spoke about Medvedev and so on, was a kind of reflection of their, attitude to Putin himself, but not Medvedev. Mm-hmm. So they could not speak about Medvedev without mentioning, or consciously or subconsciously, Putin. So he was not just independent. He was not independent in any atom of his political figure. And that's why I told that, you know, he was finished politically from the very beginning of this game. We couldn't take him seriously from the very beginning. We could discuss, public aspirations or liberal aspirations or anti-liberal aspirations in some connection. Of the figure of Medvedev and so on, but not we could not and still cannot discuss his figure, his political figure directly.
Mm.
He just doesn't exist as a politician, and that's why he cannot be finished, because he never existed.
Continuing with our with my little tandem that I have here, Mark, what about Putin? This has got to be driving him crazy, these constant rumors about his health. But yet, today, there were news reports that came out that, and these are unconfirmed, but the Japanese prime minister had apparently said in a press conference that he was canceling a trip to Russia because of Putin's health. But now, this has not been confirmed, or at least it wasn't by the time I came into the studio. But, you know, if this is coming out of Japanese news agencies that the prime minister is canceling a trip to Russia because of Putin's health on top of everything else, this is really, I mean, is this health thing just a metaphor for Putin's weakening, or is how much is Putin weakened right now?
Yeah, I think the point about this being a metaphor, I think, is a good one, because on one level, frankly, whether or not he's still in a state to wrestle bears, it's pretty irrelevant to his ability to be the steward of the country. You know, we are not talking about, you know, a Yuri Andropov ruling from the dialysis machine. We are not talking about a Brezhnev who's had to be jump-started from death a few times just to be propped in front of a camera. You know, I mean, he has his aches and pains, but nonetheless, you know, he is still an essentially physically and certainly mentally vigorous, relatively young man by global leadership standards. So it's not that we're actually talking about genuine incapacity. Precisely, I think it is just as, I mean, to be honest, I never thought I'd be in a position to be sort of defending Medvedev. I just thought sort of Kirill's categorization of him as an empty place, I thought was splendid.
We're not speaking personally.
Of course not. And just as, you know, with Medvedev exactly, you couldn't look at the sock puppet without seeing the hand. So exactly what people said about Medvedev was always a thing about Putin. But likewise, I mean, I think this health issue, the reason why it's important is firstly because it exactly speaks to Putin's existing legitimating myth, which has been built very much around Putin as the man, Putin as the, you know, whether
action
it's
man.
The action man, you know, but also obviously the man who has all the figures at his fingertips and everything else. You know, he's very much personalized the rule, and therefore actually issues about whether or not you have a slightly iffy back actually have significance. Secondly, though, what they speak to is precisely a failure to control the news cycle, a failure to control the public discourse. And this goes back to the issues we were talking about in the first half, that it is conceivably possible that the anti-corruption campaign will work, but only if you can actually shape that public narrative, only if you can actually shape that, you know, people do look at it as a, my word, if only Putin had known. If Putin can't even stop people speculating about his health, then how is he going to be able to actually convey the notion that somehow he can suddenly bring out an elite 2.0, which is efficient and dedicated and non-corrupt?
Now, I wanted to go back to something Kirill said about, because we've ridiculed the tandem mercilessly, but there is something, and it's a point that Sean Guillory's made in his blog in the past, and we've talked about it on the podcast when Sean was on, is that the Putin and Medvedev kind of make up what two sides of almost a Hegelian whole. And Kirill, you alluded to this. They both appeal to certain instincts and aspirations in different parts of the Russian public. Medvedev to the urbane, liberal, if you will, intelligentsia. Putin to the, you know, the tough, nationalistic, Siloviki oriented side of the population. And this was one of the geniuses of the tandem. That ended the day, of course, when Putin decided to return to the presidency, because the charade was over. There is no tandem. It's just Putin. Now, Medvedev is being diminished. Putin is being diminished. and nothing. There is this leadership vacuum, this Hegelian hole, if you will, to use Marx's phrase that he used on the blog years ago, is empty.
Half empty, in some sense, of course. Half empty or all empty?
You called Medvedev an empty vessel. Mark just very succinctly explained why Putin's whole public image right now is in shambles. And if we're talking about images and metaphors here, is this empty or why is it half empty?
This hole is full of, ghosts and specters, of a strong Putin, of a liberal Medvedev, of everyone around them and so on. This hole, if we'll go on with this metaphor, this hole is a, kind of focus of public aspirations and fears and so on. And it is full of everything which exists now in the public consciousness in Russia. Everything. Nationalism, liberalism, everything. And this is a kind of, it's not a structure, it's a mixture,
But it's not being channeled. I mean, in the time of the tandem, the hopes and aspirations of the society were, to a degree, channeled into
yes.
these two figures.
Yes.
Right? Now...
That was the purpose of the tandem.
That was the purpose.
Channel,
that was Pavlovsky's genius, and that was Surkov's genius. To be quite frank, now it's an empty vessel. There is a vacuum in terms of. I agree. These things are still there in society, but in the leadership, there's nothing to channel this. So this is what I mean by that this complete Hegelian hole is empty.
The hole is empty, and all this, public senses and ideas and aspirations and fears just are inside all this boiling pot of mm-hmm. Russian society, and there are no any, channels and the klapany. Right. I don't know how it's in English.
Yeah.
And it can blow.
Yeah.
It can blow. And in this sense, of course, the situation is very dangerous, because when we define such, any situation, social situation, economic situation, public situation as a politics, this definition is connected with the idea of kind of structure or political spectrum or political channels of all this energy, public energy and public aspirations, which, ever exists in any political system, political country, because that is the foundation of the thing that we call politics. And now this it's disappearing. It's mm-hmm. not disappeared, of course, totally, but it's disappearing. And this mixture, when you don't know who is it and whose man this man from Provatoro from Rostelecom and whose man is he liberal or, it doesn't matter. Nothing has any sense in this situation. So everything can... turns in a very strange way.
It's interesting. Right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was popular for political scientists to talk about the Soviet people or the Russian people in the post-Soviet context as an undifferentiated mass. Right now,
but it was very structured.
Now the society is becoming very differentiated.
Yeah,
but it's the elite.
Yes.
That appears to be becoming an undifferentiated mass. What about that, Mark? What does this portend?
Well, I think what it portends is precisely that people start looking for how they climb out of this. I mean, as it were, the Hegelian hole with a W has become a hole with an H. and in that context, I think exactly because you don't have clearly identified ideologies, certainly not within the elite. It's not as if there are people who believe in things. They have sort of general belief that Russia should be strong and so forth. But there's no real ideology beyond the status quo. And the real thing about the status quo is personal and group enrichment and survival. Even if we look at Medvedev and his talk about the presidency, it's very hard to believe that even poor little Dima actually believes that he has any kind of chance. To whom could he appeal? I mean, even sort of the notion of Medvedev as the urbane cosmopolitans president of choice becomes questionable. I mean, certainly the very first time we saw him uncomfortably wearing a leather jacket. but this talk, for me, is as much as anything else about Medvedev negotiating the best severance package he can come up with. That he knows that, you know, whether it's weeks, months, or whatever, that basically he's going to be moving out of the political system, and he wants to ensure that at least he seems consequent enough that he's worth looking after and taking care of. And I think that's the point. I think there's a lot of people who are busy looking for their severance packages, looking for their escape routes, looking for their guarantees and protections. And that's phenomenally unstable a situation for any kind of elite to be in.
And on that happy note, I guess we're going to have to wrap up today because our time in the studio is running short. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFARL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFARL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from New York City has been NYU professor Mark Galliotti, an expert on Russia security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
Thank you.
And a big thanks to our awesome producer, Tanya Koncheva, and to my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, and his equally indispensable Twitter feed, Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfarl.org, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. See you again next week. Kirill will be traveling somewhere near the North Pole, I believe, in December, a lovely place to go. But Mark will be back with us, fortunately. And as always now, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.